Wonderful. All right, everybody, we're going to get started. I want to leave as much time for questions from the audience. This, maybe more than any other panel, is a discussion that that I've put together for really for the benefit of the people in the room. So please, just as you're listening to our panelists, be thinking about questions, and you know, we'll open it up to questions from the audience, and I hope to get through a lot of them. I'm Lita Cass, Vice President for Strategic Initiatives and Director of the Freedom of Thought Project. This is an initiative to identify, explore, understand, and address and confront new threats to freedoms of thought, speech, and conscience. And I would invite you, in a completely shameless, self-serving way, to sign up for our kind of freedom of thought updates. There's QR codes on your table. I know there's an ocean of programming that we produce, but to be able to, for those of you who are specifically interested in freedom of thought content, we have some fantastic podcasts as well as other programming, and so please sign up for that. For the program today, I don't want to sort of step up. Our moderator is fantastic and is going to frame this conversation, and I guess I would just say that when I was thinking about the freedom of thought panel for this conference, we talk a lot about freedom and power, and I think some of our most important, interesting work is addressing questions, new questions about private power, and how that overlaps with effective public service. I think there's long-standing conventional wisdom on the sort of career track that you need for high-ranking, influential positions in an administration or elsewhere, and the question is sort of whether the rules have changed. To moderate this discussion, we have Judge Greg Katsas, well-known, I think, to all of you, and especially to the Freedom of Thought audience, clerked for Judge and Justice Clarence Thomas, also sort of not a stranger to freedom of thought and courage, and models, I think, courage in his own, sort of over the course of his own career in a way that inspires, does not alienate, and I'm really interested in how he is going to moderate today's discussion. Judge, floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be here. I'm not sure if this uniquely qualifies me or uniquely disqualifies me to plausibly moderate this panel, but the defining defining feature of my career has been private practice in a big law firm. I did that for 17 years, two long stints at Jones Day. I am a little bit older than my other panelists, and I think there's like a real generational issue here. If the rules have changed, they have changed over the course of my career. Things really were different when I started, and I'll just to set the tables, I'll just try to give you a sense of what things seemed to me as a committed conservative lawyer as I was starting my career and figuring out what to do. And the answer was pretty obvious. It was sort of go to a big defense firm and work and rise up through the ranks and have a career there, and then hopefully at some point go into the government for a while in a Republican administration and do some public service and then go back. And that is actually what I did. It felt to me like my time in private practice was not compromising my ideals and in many ways advancing my ideals. I graduated from law school in the late 80s. We all in those days believed in private enterprise, less regulation, lower taxes, all of those things, right? What was good for General Motors was good for America, and if you believed that, you'd be very comfortable in a Jones Day or other big law practice, right? The day-to-day paid work was often aligned and rarely, if ever, affirmatively inconsistent with kind of my general worldview. Second feature of private practice in the old days was the pro bono practice. The firms were pretty laissez-faire about what you could do. Left-leaning associates could do amicus briefs on that side of cases, and right-leaning associates could do amicus briefs on that side of cases. And, you know, at one point in my career, when Lawrence versus Texas put at risk the Defense of Marriage Act, I was allowed to bid for the business of defending DOMA. And that was really exciting. Third feature of, we didn't get the business. You know, Paul Clement got it, and you all know what happened with that. So come to the rules changing point. But the third aspect was that the revolving door for those of us who wanted to do government service, it worked for Republicans as well as for Democrats. And the first time I left Jones Day to take a litigation job in the Bush administration, there was no question in my mind that when my time in government ended, I would be welcome back at the firm. And that's how things worked on both sides of the aisle. And it never would have occurred to me that the positions I would take at DOJ in that time might constrain my options coming out. Just not on the radar screen. Those were the rules back then. Things are very different now. I won't speak much on the question of whether what's good for Google is good for America. The FOT, you know, FOT debates that issue a lot. At a minimum, right, it's much less clear than it was a generation ago. On the amicus and, you know, opportunity to do cause work in big firms, just look at Supreme Court amicus filings in any edgy case, and you'll see, you know, 50 to 100 briefs on one side of the V and zero on the other from big law. Right, the DOMA thing I mentioned, there were only two big firms that bid on that at all, my firm and Paul's firm. And a couple of years after, we bid unsuccessfully on defending the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. The court struck that down, and state DOMAs were severely at risk. And my firm had a relationship with a Republican governor that wanted us to defend the state DOMA, and we were not allowed to do that. That's even my firm, which is pretty good about these things, and just a few years after we tried to get the federal DOMA business. And then the revolving door, right, that gets harder and harder too. We had some of the best lawyers out of the Bush administration were not welcome back at their firms, and then that was accelerated massively in the Trump administration with it seeming just about every big law firm really affirmatively hostile, and I was welcome back. I think I would have been welcome back, but my firm was more an exception than a rule in that regard. So. I haven't had to deal with it. It was easy for me. It's tough for you all who are a half a generation or a full generation behind me, and that's what our panelists will address. So let me just briefly introduce them. Jonathan Mitchell is the founder of Mitchell Law PLLC, a small boutique which does a lot of interesting cause work. He's had a range of wonderful jobs, non-big firm jobs, law clerk to Justice Scalia, working in the Office of Legal Counsel in the federal government, working in state government as Solicitor General of Texas, numerous academic positions at University of Chicago and Scalia and Texas and Stanford, and couldn't find it on the resume, but at least one brief stint in big law, which I in a private firm? Never?
No.
Never? Okay. I thought, yeah, all right.
I know a lawyer for you.
All right, I thought I thought you were around the time of the first Trump transition, but maybe not.
No.
All right. Libby Locke, co-founder of Claire Locke, which is a leading plaintiff side defamation firm. Libby started, as I did, on a conventional track, graduated from a leading law school at Georgetown, clerk on a court of appeals for Judge Barksdale, and then off to Kirkland & Ellis for some 8 years, first as an associate, then as a partner, and then she left and founded her small and booming and very successful firm. Annie Donaldson, graduate of Harvard Law School, started on the big law track, first at Patton Boggs and then at Jones Day. Annie, like me, left Jones Day to go into the first Trump administration. I was a deputy in the White House counsel's office. Annie was our chief of staff. Don was the heart of the office, but Annie was the glue that just made things work all the time. The one lawyer besides Don who had responsibility for everything, and things ran pretty well because of her. She left and did not go back to big law, but went to small law. She's a partner at Luther Strange and doing some pretty interesting stuff, and very happy working out of her home in Montgomery rather than in the rat race in a big city like the rest of us. Last but certainly not least, Jonathan Skirmetti is the Attorney General of Tennessee. Before that, he was chief counsel to the governor and a chief deputy AG. He's had other government and teaching positions as well. He was an AUSA in Memphis, was in the Civil Rights Division at DOJ, an adjunct professor at University of Memphis, and a partner in Butler Snow. I'm not sure if that qualifies as big law. You can tell us about that.
Respectable medium law.
Medium law. So we have big, medium, and small here. So without further ado, I will turn the floor over to Jonathan.
All right, well, the title of our panel is On Building a Courageous and Effective Career. And the key word here is the conjunction and. It's quite easy to have a career that is courageous but ineffective. You can do that by being reckless, indiscreet, obnoxious, needlessly confrontational, airing your opinions at every opportunity, filing lawsuits that have little chances of success, tilting at windmills, or acting in ways that cause people to write you off as a blowhard or a punk. And it's easy to think of lawyers who act this way. They are not burdened by a lack of courage, but they aren't effective. They become gadflies, and they're regarded as unserious people. Even though they're too thick to realize that this is how indeed they are regarded throughout the legal profession. It's even easier to have a career that is effective but not courageous. This is, in my view, the greater temptation that we face as lawyers. These are the people who don't want to rock the boat, who go along to get along, and who often advance in their careers for those very reasons, but who never leave an impact on the law and never bring about needed change or reform. I don't intend to be judgmental toward or critical of lawyers who act this way. Many of you need to lie low if you're hoping to make partner in big law or get tenure in the legal academy, or if you're working in-house for a large corporation. That's not an act of cowardice. It's an act of self-preservation. And that's the advice I would give to any lawyer who works in those environments, whether you're at a law firm, a university, or a general counsel's office. Resistance is likely to be futile, and it's almost certain to be inimical to your career prospects with that particular employer. You should not protest if your law firm or university gives illegal hiring preferences to women or non-Asian racial minorities. You should not complain if your employer decides to pay for abortion travel. You should not install an email filter at work that automatically rejects emails sent from people who list their pronouns in their signature block. So what should you do if you want to have a courageous and effective career, but you're stuck in a place of employment that seems to make that impossible? Let me suggest four things that you can do. Number one, be a mole. Don't openly protest the illegal racial preferences or the payments for abortion travel. Instead, collect the incriminating evidence and turn it over to me so I can do it. That way, it's a win-win. You're protected from retaliation because they're not going to have any idea how I got the information. I love suing woke law firms and universities that flout the law and think they can get away with it. It's my bread and butter. It's a good pastime. But I need the evidence before I can sue. And to get the evidence, I need the moles. I've set up a website where people can submit evidence of illegal racial preferences anonymously, or you can just email it to me, or even better, talk to me here at the conference. I like moles, and I want to meet you if you're a mole, or if you're willing to be a mole. Now, if you want to talk to me and you're not a mole, I'll still be pleasant. I'm not a respecter of persons, and I'll pretend that I'm still interested in our conversation. But I really want to talk to you if you're a mole. Moles are good. Become one. All right, second option, leave. If your place of employment is hindering you from having a courageous and effective career, then you can leave, get out of there. You don't have to work at these places. I'm not working in big law, and I have never worked there, and I never will. If your goal is to have a courageous and effective legal career, then stay away from the employers that are hindering that. As Judge Katsas points out, big law firms will not allow conservative lawyers to represent any clients or work on any pro bono projects that do not pass the political correctness test that has been imposed by the corporate C-suite. Those of you who are law students, consider conservative boutique law firms like Consovoy McCarthy, Cooper Kirk, Cher Jaffe, Boyd & Gray, instead of thinking, oh, Claire Locke, instead of thinking that you have to work at big law. Take a look at career opportunities at 501c3s like America First Legal, the New Civil Liberties Alliance, or ADF. They may not pay as much as big law in terms of money, but remember, your compensation package includes the psychic income that attaches to the types of cases that you're working on. Your compensation overall is both salary and fringe benefits, but also the psychic income. And in many cases, a slightly lower salary in terms of nominal dollars can actually be greater compensation. Try to think this way when you're considering your options and you're weighing different offers that you get from different potential employers. Third, bide your time. There is a time to be courageous, and there's also a time not to be. Maybe this is the time to lay groundwork for your future actions. You may be in a situation right now in your career where, for whatever reason, you need the security or the prestige of big law. But you're thinking that in the future you might launch and start doing things that are both courageous and effective. There's nothing wrong with that. But always try to keep the long game in mind. Where am I ultimately going? How does this particular job that I'm holding right now fit into that plan? Finally, be prepared to take positions that will upset and even anger people who include some of our friends here at the Federalist Society. Professor Epstein would tell me when I was a law student that there should always be times where you take positions that disagree with your normal ideological and jurisprudential allies. If that never happens, that could be a reflection of lack of courage or a lack of critical thinking. Being courageous doesn't simply mean attacking ideas held by our friends or our non-friends on the left. It also means challenging and refining arguments espoused by our friends in the Federalist Society and in the conservative legal movement. Just because a belief is held by conservatives or libertarians or Republicans doesn't mean that the idea is automatically right. And pointing out vulnerabilities in the conventional wisdom on the right is a valuable and necessary service. Now, that will occasionally make some people angry or upset. There are people at this very convention here this weekend who are still furious at me over amicus briefs that I've filed or other actions that I've taken. I hope they'll get over it someday. I view it as a lover's quarrel. They don't. But that comes with the territory. Be prepared for that. And don't allow that to deter or hinder you from doing what you think is right.
Libby.
I think there's going to be a theme here. 60 years ago, the United States Supreme Court handed down its decision in New York Times versus Sullivan, holding that the First Amendment requires public figures suing for defamation to demonstrate that publishers of defamatory falsehoods acted with actual malice. The press hails Sullivan as a landmark decision for press freedom because it, and the cases that follow it, impose on defamation plaintiffs a nearly insurmountable hurdle for bringing and winning defamation claims to vindicate their own good reputation. And they impose one of the highest standards under civil law, highest standards of proof under civil law to win a claim. And no doubt, Sullivan set into motion 60 years of First Amendment jurisprudence and state legislative action, creating and increasing an ever more onerous, increasingly onerous barriers to bringing and winning a defamation case under US law. From very short statute of limitations, journalist privileges that shield journalists from civil discovery, anti-slap statutes with mandatory fee shifting, and there are plenty more protections for the press. These defamation cases are some of the most difficult to bring and win. So that was 60 years ago. This started 10 years ago. My law partner and now husband, Tom Clare, and I left Kirkland & Ellis, where we were both litigation partners, to launch Clarelock LLP, where we specialize in bringing and winning plaintiff-side defamation claims against the media. We've litigated some of the biggest defamation claims in the last decade and won them, including securing a $787.5 million settlement on behalf of Dominion Voting Systems against Fox News. Doesn't necessarily make me the most popular person in the room sometimes, especially in a room like this. We also won a record-setting $52 million FINRA defamation verdict, award, I should say, and a multi-million dollar verdict in front of a unanimous jury on behalf of a University of Virginia dean of students who was falsely accused by Rolling Stone of covering up a gang rape on UVA's campus, an article that was a hoax in and of itself. And so for the past 10 years, even before candidate Donald Trump campaigned on the idea that we needed to open up the libel laws, my firm has been leading the conversation that the United States Supreme Court should overturn Sullivan, that judge-made policy decision that is completely untethered from the text, history, or structure of the Constitution. Sorry, I digress. I can't help myself. So when the Federalist Society approached me to speak on this panel about building a courageous and effective career, no doubt the idea was for me to speak about the substantive work that I do in defamation law. But when I sat down to write this speech, I really spent some time thinking about what have I done in my career that has really been courageous. I left out the effective part, but as any good textualist would, I'm here at the Federalist Society, I got out my dictionary to look up what is the precise meaning of the word courageous. Oxford says that courage is the ability to do something that frightens one, or strength in the face of pain or grief, or to act on one's beliefs despite danger or disapproval. Now, I'm not sure that my work suing the media qualifies under any of those definitions. Is it frightening to sue the media? Is it strength in the face of danger? I'm not sure about that. It's actually quite a lot of fun, and perhaps a little crazy, too. Whoever the guy was that came up with that old adage, you don't want to pick a fight with someone who buys ink by the barrel, surely would have advised against making an entire career out of doing just that. But rather, in thinking about what has been the thing in my career that has caused me the most fear, or where I acted on my beliefs despite danger and possible disapproval, it was by far and away my decision to leave Big Law and launch Clarelock LLP. Not because of the substantive work that we do. Instead, I'm talking about the decision to walk away from a massive law firm with a steady stream of clients, a guaranteed paycheck, the opportunity for a big bonus at the end of the year, the title, the prestige, and the built-in social network that comes along with being a partner in Big Law. And doing so with a mortgage, two kids under two, and with all the uncertainty that comes with starting a new business. That struck fear into my heart. But as I moved up through the ranks in Big Law, I increasingly saw an institution that no longer represented and reflected my values. When I joined Kirkland, it was home to, or recently had been home to, the likes of many conservative lawyers, legal lions in their own right. Ken Starr, Brett Kavanaugh, Paul Clement, Chris Landau, Pat Cipollone, Jeff Wall, Steve Engel, you name them, so many others who we know and love here at the National Lawyers Convention and who have gone on to have truly courageous careers. But by the time I left Kirkland, the culture had shifted significantly, and in my view, not for the better. Now, I don't mean to pick on Kirkland exclusively, but it's the place where I have firsthand knowledge and spent very formative years of my career. To be sure, I had incredible mentors and training opportunities that many young lawyers would envy. It formed me as the lawyer I am in the work that I'm able to do today. But it is a case study on how big law itself has changed over the past 15 to 20 years. As we sit here today, think about any top 20 Am law firm and how that firm's website presents itself to the public. We could write it together. We're one massive law firm with thousands of lawyers across dozens of offices here in the US and abroad, and we use lots of buzzwords, corporate speak, and accolades, and showcase our accolades and awards about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and ESG initiatives, and our social commitments. And the website is populated with case studies about the progressive pro bono matters that we've handled. And we talk about how great we are at promoting women and minorities. And within the walls of Big Law, leadership is vying for the same talent from Yale, Stanford, and other elite, read progressive, law schools, where faculty are teaching young legal minds that all law is politics, and free speech is perfectly acceptable, provided it's speech that the faculty and administration agree with. Notwithstanding the lip service that these firms pay to being meritocracies, they pay in lockstep. Careers are advanced through a routinized process, with key promotions only being considered at preordained intervals. These are not courageous institutions. Quite the opposite. They are incredibly risk-averse, filled with leaders who are motivated by, and perhaps rationally in their own economic self-interest, a strong desire to preserve the institution that they work at. That results in very collectivist thinking. It does not lend itself to taking on controversial clients, mission-driven legal work, or having individual lawyers stand up and voice an objection where leadership makes a decision or speaks for the firm in a manner that's inconsistent with his or her values. It incentivizes conservative lawyers to keep their heads down, not to make waves, and do so in order to advance their own individual careers as one small part of the collective. Recent years have shown what happens when conservative lawyers in big law don't act or speak in lockstep. Lawyers litigating Second Amendment cases in front of the United States Supreme Court and winning those decisions are unceremoniously told that they may no longer represent their clients at that firm. Or lawyers, female lawyers in supposedly safe spaces to discuss the Dobbs decision express their view that the decision was correctly decided. Those types of lawyers have faced serious professional consequences. I saw that this shift was starting to happen 10 years ago when I began considering leaving big law and leaving all the comforts of big law to start ClearLock was the most fear-inducing decision I ever made. But it has also been by far the most rewarding, personally, professionally, economically, and socially. It has allowed me to take on conservative clients who have been unfairly defamed by the media, like Sarah Palin and Project Veritas, folks who I'm pretty sure that no major law firm today would dare to add to their list of clients. And it has allowed me to recruit, hire, and retain and train lawyers who want to do incredibly high quality work on ripped from the headlines matters for name brand clients lawyers who either share my conservative values or, at minimum, share the view that it's okay to agree to disagree on political issues, and we can still have respectful dialogue about our differing views, and we can still stand shoulder to shoulder in our firm's mission to protect our clients' reputations. So to the lawyers listening here in this room and on the web, how do you build a courageous and effective career? My biggest piece of advice is consider taking a career with a path less traveled, one outside of big law. Stop giving economic control over your livelihood to institutions who do not share your values and who can end your career if you dare speak up in support of those values. There are a growing number of boutique firms around the country started by courageous lawyers who I am confident would love to hire talented lawyers sitting in this room. Jonathan's named several here tonight. So go to one of those firms or start your own firm. There were 2,400 lawyers sitting in last night's gala dinner who you have to draw on for support and advice and who may not agree with you on every political issue du jour, but who will not be offended by your conservative or libertarian viewpoints. Don't worry about the prestige, the money, or the title you think you may be giving up. The hard work will bring all of those things in time, and it will be so, so much more rewarding when you do it on your own terms. So I'll end where I started. Suing the media for a living, that doesn't take courage, but walking away from and rejecting a career in big law certainly does.
Well, you're about to see the two sides of the podium here. We've got the very prepared lawyers over here, and then we've got the, you know, seat of the pants government guys over here. I'm not speaking for Attorney General, but for myself. Thank you. So I'm going to approach this in a little different way, maybe a slightly less intellectual, and I don't plan to cite any Supreme Court cases. Unfortunately, that's just not my style. But I want to first beg a little indulgence for the folks watching on video. In the room, how many folks have been out of law school, or either in law school or have been out for less than, let's say, 5 years? Fantastic. Welcome. Welcome. This panel is hopefully for you. I want to encourage you to have courage, not just in your career and as you're thinking about this, but in your life. Because the two are totally intertwined. There is no separating one from the other. And as you go further and further in your life, I think you'll reach a point in time where things will stop feeling like they're so hard that you have to struggle for every little bit, you have to agonize over every little decision in your life. You have to worry about closing off one thing to take another step. And you'll realize at some random point in time, after you've been out of law school for 10 or more years, you'll look back and you'll say, you know what? Everything worked out. And I'm confident in that. So I want to just lead with this thought as you're thinking about that. So have courage in your life and your career. I'm not sure any of us on stage, I'm pretty sure, maybe Jonathan Mitchell had this in mind, but I'm not sure any of us on stage had any idea we'd end up on all of the adventures we were on. There was no way we could plan all this. I don't think you were planning on creating a juggernaut of a law firm while juggling kids at home. So lots of things in life require courage and confidence, and part of what you guys that just put up your hands are naturally struggling with maybe right now is the confidence to know, hey, I'm going to make a decision, I'm going to stick by it. Maybe it was right, maybe it was wrong, but I was confident in that decision. So let me speak to you guys first, and then I'll open this up to why I think I've been asked to sit on this panel. A lot of things require courage and confidence. Being open to getting on a different path in the first place. It is hard, especially if you're at one of these top 15, top 20 law schools, to understand maybe I don't want to do the thing that my career services office and my alumni engagement also read money office, donations office, want me to do. It's okay to get on one of those paths. It's okay to be open to one of those paths. If you want to do that, fine. I will tell you my story in law school. I started out before law school. I worked for Romney as governor. I was really interested in campaigns and elections. I was working really closely with a bunch of lawyers who encouraged me to go to law school. Yes, back then, people did encourage other people to go to law school. I was grateful that for that advice. But I knew I wasn't quite the normal student. I was 5 years older than everyone else. I'd kind of already had a career that was somewhat successful. And I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, but I learned very quickly what I didn't want to do. And it was write briefs. No offense, Judge.
Different strokes for different folks.
I think Judge Katz is probably happy that I was not trying to write briefs too. But I knew I was going to be on a different path. I knew that some of the things that my classmates were doing were just not appealing to me. I knew I was on Law Review, and there was a day in Law Review. You guys probably at law school remember this day where every judge calls every clerkship candidate back, and the only thing going on campus, at least where I was waiting for a phone call and scrambling to decide which city you were going to interview in. I was the only person that didn't put in a single application. I didn't clerk. That was really weird where I was. But I had the courage and the confidence. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't recognize that it was those two things. But I just knew that that wasn't for me. Why? Because the next presidential cycle happened to fall right over when I would have been clerking, and I couldn't be involved. And I said, I want to do that instead. So have courage, have confidence. Even if you don't recognize it at that stage, you will recognize it later on in life. Stick with the path that you want to be on. If you feel it's right, even if it's not the well-worn path. There were plenty of times that everybody else in law school was saying, why aren't you clerking? Why aren't you this? Why aren't you that? If it feels good to you, if you think that's the right thing, do that. Don't be scared of taking chances. Fighting to break the mold is really hard once you're in it. But you do need to fight to break the mold when it's time. And if you feel it's time, go ahead and do those things. Listen to your own heart. You will know. But you have to be proactive in searching it. I think one of the things that we've all seen either our friends or ourselves get on is you get in a rut. It's really easy to cash a mid-six-figure paycheck these days and pay off all your loans and go on a trip that you may or may not get to enjoy because people are emailing you the whole time and do some of those things. But if that's where you are and you're feeling like it's not right, search your heart and listen to it. Big law is transactional. It will suck out your soul. It will give you a lot of money in the exchange. It will also give you a lot of training. Maybe somebody up here is saying, don't ever consider big law. Big law may be right for you. It may be right for you at certain times in your life. So that is my advice to the young folks up here. On to why I think I'm sitting here. We are on the precipice of a second term for Donald Trump. There is a lot going on in Washington right now. There's probably a lot going on in the hallway right there. Somebody might be getting their dream job, and they don't even know it. So let's talk about that. Suddenly, after law school, I went and did the Romney campaign, learned a whole lot on that, went and joined Patton Boggs, kind of not the traditional law firm for a Harvard law grad, but felt right there, had a great career there, ended up at Jones Day, got to meet Judge Katsas and many, many other brilliant people over there. It was very transactional. That's where I was at the time. We happened to have some presidential candidate clients, one of whom happened to be Donald Trump, and he happened to win. That was a new experience for me. As someone who had experienced a few elections, I didn't know that people could actually win on the Republican side and have government jobs. But suddenly, again, if you think about it now, there was courage and confidence. But at some points in time in your career, you will just feel like you're putting one foot in the other and doing what needs to be done. That's okay too. You'll know the right thing there too. But lightning struck, and suddenly we're in transition, and we're being asked who should get jobs in different places for a very different profile of president than we had seen before. In the Bush administration, there were folks that came directly from Texas, from the governor's office. There were folks that came from Bush 1, the father's administration. There were brilliant lawyers, most of whom came from big law partnership positions, who filled all these positions. It's a very different profile. Whatever else you think of Donald Trump, he has broken the stranglehold of that career path as the way to be successful and get a government job and a good government job and maybe even a very important government job. If you look at who was just announced as the Solicitor General, he is an absolute, John Sauer is an absolutely brilliant guy. He is absolutely going to be a wonderful thing for this country. He is absolutely boggling the minds of Washington right now, because that is not how you've ever gotten that job before, going through a state AG's office and doing small law. None of those things make sense to old school, old guard Washington. Take advantage of those things, but also know that the folks that make these decisions are not just looking for this pedigree that kind of Judge Katsas was talking about of a generation or a half a generation ago. They're looking for people who are courageous, who are effective, and who are willing to learn and continue being courageous and effective. So I'll pause there and turn it over to General Scamati.
Thanks, Annie. And you covered. You covered a little bit of what I want to cover, so I'll just go fast and be redundant but quickly with respect to that. So legal education is a process, and for a long time people have recognized that you are molded by the process. You get your lawyer brain, you start to think about the world in different ways, you evaluate conflicts in different ways. It's long recognized that you are formed by the education experience, and that has not changed. And then when you go to a law school, and this varies to some extent depending on the law school, I think the pressure to conform is probably greatest at the elite schools, in part because a lot of the people who got in there by being really good at conforming to the highest standards that were in front of them in the prior schools. So the pressures are a little bit different, but the opportunities are also different. So the converse is, if you go to a non-elite school, you have to often work a lot harder to open the same doors that folks just walk into if they go to the Harvards and Yales and Stanfords of the world. But if you go to the Harvards, Yales, Stanfords, all the way through those dozens of top schools, there is a treadmill set up from the second you hit the door there. When I started at law school, I think, I may be wrong, but I think about 80% of the class said that they wanted to go into public interest work when they graduated. And I was not one of them. And come graduation, there were maybe 5% of us that did that. The whole school was structured in a way to steer people toward the law firms that paid to recruit there, that gave a lot of money to the school. It was easy. It was easy. There was not a lot of friction. You do well in your classes. You do the best you can. I had some people who didn't work at all in law school because they said, well, even if I do a lousy job, I'm still going to roll out to a big law job, and then I can start working hard and get good at law, and I don't need to worry about these 3 years. I'm just going to have fun, which is unbelievably entitled, but also true. You get put on this conveyor belt that inevitably, unless you really, really, really messed up, would bring you into a big law firm with a six-figure salary and the opportunity, if you continued grinding out your time there, to advance and advance and advance. But the thing is, the longer you go, the more friction there is to get off the treadmill. It is so easy to get on, and the longer you're on, the more comfortable you get. There are financial obligations, right? The golden handcuffs are real. Once you have a family and you're providing for your family and you achieve a certain lifestyle, it is increasingly hard to walk away from that. And so you're kind of trapped, and people break out. Even people who have been in big law for 20 years, they can find opportunities to get out. It's just hard. It is so easy and so comfortable to stay on that track once you get on it that you have to be a little persnickety to get out. And the problem is, the very conformity that you're molded into has become increasingly totalitarian over time. Our culture, our elite culture especially, has started to be less and less tolerant of dissent and more punishing of people who don't fit the mold. So before, you could be a little iconoclastic and still be very successful. And you'd be a little quirky, right? You'd be like the guy who always wears pink shirts, or even if you were ideologically divergent, it didn't tar you as a bad person who should not be tolerated. There was room for everybody, and that's not the case anymore. Part of that's driven by clients, part of that's driven by the leadership of the firms, and part of that is just driven by the culture that we're in right now. And so that makes it even harder to break the mold, because to advance when you're on that treadmill moving through the law firm, not only do you have to conform to the hours billed and to the general, you can't be entirely bland unless you're, a tax and estate lawyer, but you have to be pretty bland to make it through and find ways to distinguish and market yourself, but not too much. You can't be too weird. You gotta be essentially fungible, but really good at one particular niche. You also have to toe the party line on all of the political stuff. So as the DEI ESG commitments become deeper and deeper and deeper at these institutions, you're gonna have to do things that may compromise your own deeply held beliefs. And maybe you become a mole, maybe you make just enough money, you hit your threshold and you're out of there. But it becomes increasingly hard as you become the shape of the thing that fills the hole that you're supposed to be filling. So I think it is important to be aware of the risk. And for a lot of people who do not want to get into that situation, it is much safer to break the mold earlier. And law schools, especially the most elite schools, have career services places that will show you alternatives. And it is just so important to know that once you take another step down the big law path, it's just harder to step off the path. And there are people who want that. I've got some friends who are very, very happy in big law, but I also have some friends who wanted to be conservative iconoclasts who are just not, and it would be a lot of work for them to become conservative iconoclasts. But the converse of that is, as people on the right are driven out of the elite institutions, there are a lot more opportunities if you're willing to break the mold, right? I think to get a job in the Trump administration, any sort of high-level policymaking job, it's going to be really hard for somebody who does not engage in costly signaling beforehand. And Annie told me not to use this analogy, but I'm going to use it. If you look at gang activity in, say, Central America or East Asia, right? Like, seriously, everybody is covered in tattoos, and that's because it shows your commitment. Once you have burned the boats on the shore, you are not going back. And so with the Trump administration, it sure seems like they are looking for people who have burned the heck out of those boats. And, it's basically either go into the administration or, go to one of three or four law firms, or you're not going to have a whole lot of opportunities. And that's a way of indicating that you are not molded by this pervasive and overwhelming culture of, woke blandness, I guess you could call it. But there are so many opportunities out there for people who are willing to identify themselves in a way that constrains the opportunities on the traditional route. So if you are willing to be a brave conservative lawyer, you can go work for the government, get into court a lot. And that's the key theme for the young lawyers. You have to develop competencies such that it doesn't matter where you're working. If you're good, you'll be fine. If you get into court all the time and you're a good trial lawyer, you've got a living. You can hang a shingle. There's all sorts of things that you can do. People will want you if you're good, even if you're otherwise yucky. And because there is such an asymmetry in the number of lawyers on the right versus the number of lawyers on the left, there is a huge need for lawyers on the right, and you will get insane opportunities. If you work hard, you stay humble, you're willing to learn. If you go in demanding to be the Solicitor General of a state, unless you're really, 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 really good, that's not gonna happen. But you can get into an AG's office, you can get into the federal government, you can get into a governor's office, you can get into a legislative office, and if you work hard, people will notice that. And I assure you, there are very short lists of good, hardworking, conservative attorneys out there, and people will find opportunities. And once you have those opportunities under your belt, that opens additional doors. Maybe you're still not going to get back into the traditional law firms, but maybe you don't want to get back in the traditional law firms. Working in the Tennessee AG's office when I was the chief deputy, which, again, I got that job because there were very, very few conservative lawyers in Tennessee willing to work for a government salary. It was not because I'm amazing, it's because I was willing. And I ended up after just a couple of years as a frontline negotiator on like a $30 billion settlement in the most complicated civil litigation in American history. If I ever don't want to work for the government, I am going to be okay. And that's an opportunity that most people would kill for, but you know, to get into the avenue to do that kind of work for a red state, it's more a matter of just showing up. I mean, we are desperate to recruit. And so if you come in and work hard, you are opening doors. You develop those skills, you find your niches, and you'll be okay. You know, the list for federal judgeships, even now, not that long in a lot of districts. Part of it's because some people are very content with the amount of money they make. Part of it's because there just aren't that many lawyers on the right, and there's not that many good lawyers on the right. And so if you can show that you're a good lawyer on the right, there's always going to be in a Republican administration a need for people to staff the federal agencies, a need for U.S. attorneys, a need for judges, a need for people to go into all sorts of positions of great responsibility. And so, you know, rather than being confined by your inability to conform, you're setting yourself up for a very rarefied set of opportunities where there's not as much competition. And I probably shouldn't be saying this, because now I'm going to be steering people who just don't want to compete hard to pretend that they're conservatives because the jobs are there, which I think happens frequently with Supreme Court clerkships. My impression is because you've got a lot more on the right than on the left, there are a lot of people who want to clerk for the Supreme Court who are trying to signal rightness when that's not necessarily where their heart is. But the cost, if you're not in the Supreme Court category of attorneys, is much higher, I think, for the rest of us. But the opportunities are there, and you can be a really good lawyer without being a lawyer who fits the mold that has been set up for you. We have a system, a legal system, that is predicated on the adversarial process, right? You get to an answer in a case by disagreeing. And you can disagree civilly, you can disagree constructively, but your job is to take a position and fight for it. We have an elite culture that is predicated on consensus, and dissent is increasingly viewed as something that's bad or inappropriate or stupid or gross. Well, what that means is the people who are molded into this system are inherently less capable of thriving in our adversarial legal system than the people in law school who are throwing their hands up disagreeing with the professor about every major precedent and pushing their point of view and willing to fight for it and getting pushback. And people have started to notice this. If you are a left-leaning law student, you are receiving wisdom much more than you are being challenged. If you're a right-leaning law student, you are constantly swimming against the tide, and that makes you stronger, and that means that you're willing and able to take advantage of these opportunities for the people who do engage in costly signaling. So I guess all this is a way of saying it's not really courageous, it's self-interested for you to step out and be a conservative attorney. I think the reason I'm up here is because I have filed a bunch of lawsuits that are yucky by the standards of the legal consensus. But some of them are kind of scary. I sued BlackRock. I was the first AG to sue BlackRock, and there were a bunch of posts on social media that appeared to be unconnected to one another of people saying, if he commits suicide in the next couple weeks, it's not really suicide. And that is really disconcerting, right? Like a $9 trillion asset manager that's pretty irritated at me. That's kind of scary, but it's the right thing to do. And, you know, there are a number of billionaires who I'm informed really dislike me personally now, which, again, really scary. But it's the right thing to do. And, like, you don't go to law school to be bored, right? Like, most people go to law school based on the idea. If you go to law school to be rich, you're in the wrong place, right? There are so many industries that are better suited if all you want is money. You go to law school because you love our institutions, you love our history, you love our country, and whether you're in private practice or public service, you can change the country for the better through the adversarial process or by giving people good advice. So there's an inherent altruism that draws us all to the law. And when you're put in a position to fight the fights that absolutely need to be fought to put our country back on track, it is an incredible privilege, even if it is really scary, even if it means that, like, I'll be lucky to get a tenure-track professorship at the end of it. I don't think I will, but, you know, If you look historically, and this is a very rough analogy, right? Like, I understand there are big differences, but there have been marginalized populations in the past that were not given the big law consensus opportunities. I have friends who were Jewish lawyers in the 70s, and they did not have opportunities to join the big firms, and they and their compatriots started firms, or they found niches and got so good at them that it was irresistible to hire them. And they were able to find these opportunities. They did not have the advantages that lawyers on the right have of access at any given time to at least roughly half the state's AG offices and occasionally to the federal government, where, again, because of the shortage, you can rise very quickly if you are competent, and you will be given opportunities and responsibilities that a lot of attorneys would kill for just because there are so few willing to identify themselves on the right side. So be brave, young law students, young lawyers. The opportunities are there. There's nothing wrong with going into big law. There's nothing wrong with going into a firm. Just do it with eyes open and know that it's going to be hard to get out. But people do it. And there is a whole lot of fun on the active, courageous, conservative, loud, occasionally anathematized, but very consequential right side of the legal profession.
A lot of agreement on the panel, but I will invite each of the panelists to give you all an opportunity to comment on what you heard from your co-panelists. So, Jonathan?
Well, sounded good to me.
Libby? Or you?
Like I said, I think there's a lot of consensus here. It sounded like the left side of the table was a little bit more open to big law career. And yes, I mean, you get a lot of training opportunities. I think that there are those training opportunities and the same economic opportunities in if you want to go in and do civil litigation. Maybe you don't. Maybe you want to go into government. Maybe you want to go into, you know, public interest work. But if you want to be a civil litigator, there are those same opportunities out there, and I think it's kind of the golden age of boutique law firms. You're seeing more and more the rise of these boutique firms from lawyers who have those conservative values and who are going against the grain. And so I would say solicit and seek those opportunities. I do agree with, you know, I'm not advising for first years out of law school to go and hang your own shingle. I do agree you've got to have some professional competence and skills and training before you do that, and that goes to the effective part that I missed in my yeah. talk. So.
I think also just you can get skills and training on your own. I don't think you need to rely on big law to become a good writer or a good lawyer. You can be self-taught. Just read stuff that's really good. Make sure you're reading that. And make sure you're watching people who are good at what they're doing. But I don't think you should think that you need to go to big law in order to get the training you need to be a good lawyer.
Yeah, I think you raise a good point. I do think you need, especially young lawyers, and it's really hard right now because of work from home and post-COVID policies and stuff like that. One of the things that I found that people that kind of navigated the big law and got out or navigated the big law and then decided what they wanted to do very successfully, they found a mentor. Find a mentor. It might not be the person you think is a mentor, and it's certainly, well, not certainly, but it's unlikely to be that you've just sought somebody out randomly. Look at your law school classmates and cohorts. Look at the alums. Look at the folks in this room. Look at the folks who are on panels. And seek them out. Try to work for them. Try to intern for them. And again, right now is a very exciting time because there's so much disruption. There's when Washington turns over, there's a cascade. It's not just the federal jobs. It's certainly not just the executive branch federal jobs. Well, who's going to take some of those jobs? Folks on the Hill. You can go work for the folks on the Hill, some of the senators. There's new senators. There's plenty of opportunities there. What else is open? States. Some of these state SGs and other state staffers are going to become judges. They're going to go to the federal government. There's going to be state jobs open. Where else is that going to be? Some of the boutique law firms. There's so much cascade, so many opportunities. So I think just, again, this is not necessarily be courageous in your career advice, but it's just life advice. go find somebody that you respect, that you think is a good writer, that you think is an awesome trial attorney or a lawyer that does something that you want to do and you really respect. Go try to work for them. Maybe they have a job open. Maybe they can say, I don't, but I know who does. I know, especially in government and politics, a lot of career is just bouncing back and forth between people you respect and want to work for and somebody coming to you and say, hey, do you have a good guy for this or gal for this? So I'll do that. One other thing I want to just point out to the folks that didn't raise their hand in the room and could probably equally do a good job on this panel, everyone has a responsibility to make sure that this works on the other end. So it's sometimes very easy for us to get wrapped around our current jobs and our families and what's going on at home and things like that. But I will just put out, the importance of supporting the people that are either in public life and having a rough time and doing a lot of sacrifice and maybe getting raked over the coals in the New York Times or whatever, but also the folks that are struggling or looking for jobs early in their careers. It is incumbent upon us to make sure that we take care of both people that may have bled a little bit in for the cause, but also people who are still looking for their path. And so I do want to just put out that reminder. It's a reminder to all of us on a daily basis, except for maybe General Scarametti, who is literally begging for people to come work for him.
Yes. I am not above begging. The other thing I want to say is a lot of people don't necessarily know what their ideological valence is in law school, and maybe it takes them a while to come to it. There are people who get into big law and realize at some point that they are conservative and they don't fit in and they want to look at something different. I know somebody who's extremely active in the conservative movement now who went to a big, significant elite law school and did not do any of the conservative stuff, didn't really know that he was right-leaning, figured it out later in life and jumped in and made a big difference. And we don't hire partisanly in my office, but if you're going to be suing the Biden administration with incredible gusto and aggression, you're probably not going to do well if you're not sincerely focused on that. So there are positions where there are just natural gravitation for people who are on the right. There are also a lot of positions where it's a foot in the door and you have an opportunity to prove yourself. And if you want to be a career civil servant and decide in the long run you don't want to do something ideological, that's fine too. We need good lawyers, and there are people who have spent their entire career and have a very sophisticated practice with a ton of responsibility who don't do anything to indicate or affiliate with any particular ideology. But if you want to be a judge, you've got to show whoever's in office that whichever side they're on, you're on their side. If you want to get political appointments, if you want to get significant policy-oriented supervisory positions, you have to lay down your marker. And that may mean going to one of the boutiques. That may mean writing something, saying something, participating in certain groups. But it's a costly signal. And when you do that, you're going to open some doors, but you're going to close others. And that's just the trade-off of the world. The other thing I would say is if you're not sure of what you want to do, you can go to a boutique. You can go into big law and think that you might want to leave. But government service really is great. I was fortunate enough to get into the honors program at Justice, and I know that's a really tall order for a lot of people. I was super lucky. But there are a ton of government jobs out there, and any government agency that litigates, they need people, and there's opportunity, and if you do a good job, you're going to create new opportunities for yourself, and it is awesome. When I was 4 years out of law school, I had a presidential assassination conspiracy case. I had a really significant sex trafficking case. I had a really significant police corruption case. And I was a baby lawyer. I mean, it is so much more fun when you were given that responsibility early on. And it breeds courage in you when you have to deal with dangerous people and you're given a lot of responsibility early. You just get used to being in scary situations and it becomes less intimidating.
Open the floor up for questions. I'm just moderator's prerogative. Let me ask one, which is just for Libby and Annie, big law track, and then a kind of career-defining moment, opening your firm and chief of staff in the counsel's office. But just first first job, right, you need some skills. You need a little bit of stature before you can open your firm. Presumably, some of the stuff you learned at Jones Day helped you be a great chief. Like, if you had it to do over again, are you glad you did the big law track for the first part of your career to get those skills and get your feet on the ground? Or do you just think now that's not necessary anymore? You just do that at a boutique or whatever, or in government?
I think the times have changed. I think, you know, as kind of I said, like 15, 20 years ago, there weren't the same kind of boutique mm-hmm. opportunities, and I don't think there was the same risk profile at a lot of these big firms. I think it was starting to change. But you, going into big law, you weren't beholdening yourself to an institution that was hostile to your values. And so I think my answer is I had a really good training and really good mentors at Kirkland. You know, rest his soul, Ken Starr was a mentor of mine. I worked with Chris Landau and others, Jeff Wall. I mean, I learned some incredible skills there. And so I have a lot of positive things to say, but I don't think today is the same as it was 20 years ago. I'm dating myself. When I started my career. And so I guess my thesis is that you don't have to give your economic livelihood over to somebody who is, to an institution that's hostile to your core beliefs and your core values. You have other opportunities in a way that you didn't perhaps need 20 years ago, and now you do.
Yeah, for me, I never really went on the big law track. I did end up at big law, but it was because that's where the people that I knew and I knew I wanted to work for happened to be at the time. So I never ended up saying, okay, I'm just a first year at a big nameless, faceless law firm that I chose basically from a hat or because somebody had the best reception or, you know, my friends were going there or whatever. So I don't know that my experience is necessarily a overly instructive one, but it goes back to my point earlier, which is find people that you want to work for and you want to learn from, and maybe they're at big law. I know a lot of really great conservative lawyers who are at big law, and if you can go and work for them and learn skills from them, and that's what you want to do, that's great. If they're at a boutique, that's great, maybe even better in a way. If they're an attorney general or an SG at a state attorney general office, go do that. So I think that my answer is the same answer I give to a lot of things, which is if somebody offers you a job that you really respect, say yes. You never know when you've just interviewed for your dream job. I interviewed for my dream job like 5 years before I got my dream job, and I didn't know it until, you know, suddenly we find ourselves walking into White House counsel's office on January 20th, 2017. So, you know, you never know when you've interviewed for your dream job. But if you find an opportunity that you want to go after and you say yes, whether it's yes at a big law firm or yes at an attorney general's office or yes at a government's office, I would encourage that to be something that you live by.
Can I just add one thing to my, you know, thinking about this training point in big law, I think big law is also, you know, perhaps a bit different from 15 or 20 years ago now, insofar as the institutional clients that big law has and the fewer opportunities for training and trials. You just don't get that anymore in the way that you used to. And so I also think it's a little bit of a, you know, you would go to big law 20 years ago and there would be trial opportunities, and now there just aren't. And so you want to stand up in court. Going to big law is not going to provide you that training that you're going to need to go off and be a litigator. So, you know, there's, I think the training question is not quite, the answer isn't necessarily big law for the training.
Let's take some questions. Ed.
Ed Whalen, Ethics and Public Policy Center. A comment on a silver lining that hasn't been mentioned yet, and then also a question for Jonathan about a big dark cloud that hasn't been discussed. On the silver lining, Greg, when you and I clerked together for the court 30 plus years ago, we would never have guessed that the three law clerks coming out of that clerk class that would end up on the Federal Courts of Appeals would be you, Dan Collins and Jeff Sutton. And the fact that that happened owes to a lot of things, but among other things, it's thank you, Harry Reid. It's the abolition of the filibuster for lower court nominees, now Supreme Court nominees, also executive branch nominees. And what that means is there are all sorts of opportunities to get appointed to judgeships and senior positions in the executive branch that would not have been possible years ago. And you don't need, if you're competent, no one needs to start talking about recess appointments. My question on the for Jonathan on the cloud, we haven't mentioned academia at all. Greg mentioned that you had gone through these, you know, different law schools. In a sane world, with your command of federal courts, you would have all the law schools in the country chasing after you to teach federal courts there. Instead, you know, you weren't very welcome. Is there anything that can be done? It seems worse than ever, from what I can tell, in the legal academy. Is there anything that can be done to improve that situation?
Yes. Sue them. I've already filed a lawsuit against Northwestern University over its use of race and sex preferences in faculty hiring, as well as the Northwestern University Law Review's use of race and sex preferences when choosing articles and student editors. So to get these lawsuits off the ground, I need moles. So you can be a mole in big law. You can also be a mole in the legal academy. And I think both are exceedingly valuable. But everyone knows, as Ed points out, everyone knows this stuff is going on. In order to prove it in court, we will need smoking gun evidence from people on the inside who can turn that stuff over. So do we have any law professors in this room or people who are employed by? All right, oh, of course, Josh Kleinfeld. Well. Oh, how are things going on at your law school? Well, also, you can recruit other moles from academia if possible. But people will change their behavior when they fear lawsuits. That's the key. We saw this in Texas with the Texas Heartbeat Act, when Texas passed a law that exposed abortion providers to civil lawsuits. It shut down post-heartbeat abortions, even though Roe against Wade hadn't been overturned yet. So when you can create that environment, when they know we'll be sued if we do this, then the behavior will change. So that's really the answer to your question, Ed. It's may not be the, so we're working on it, you know. Hope.
All right, other side of the room, on my left. Yes, sir.
Hi, David Latt. I'm a legal journalist. I have a Substack newsletter and podcast called Original Jurisdiction. I also love hearing from moles. My question, I wanted to pick up on something that some of you have alluded to, which is the piece about clients. It was reported when Paul and Aaron left Kirkland that some of that was because of pressure from transactional clients of Kirkland's. And I speak to a lot of Federalist Society student and lawyer chapters about these issues, and I'm very pro free speech and intellectual diversity. And the piece of pushback I get from the audience, and remember, these are FedSoc audiences, is I get two pieces of pushback about clients. One, often FedSoc members who are partners at law firms say, well, it's easy for, you know, you people to talk about all of these things, but how do you know what it's like to lose, you know, eight figures of business because you have this one little conservative pro bono client, and what your partners are going to tell you if you don't go along with losing that eight-figure piece of business? And then the second piece of pushback I got in these FedSoc talks, which is a little more surprising to me, is lawyers who were defending this as on a normative level as either neutral or good because of two things. One, when clients pressure law firms dump certain clients, well, you know, look, people have First Amendment speech and associational rights, and it's the right of these clients to do that. And two, for those of us who are for Federalist Society people, you should like free markets. And so what is wrong with well-heeled clients voting with their dollars and saying, if you, law firm X, are not going to support our views, well, we're going to take our business somewhere else. So I guess my question is, what's the deal with clients?
All right, wow. There's a lot going on there.
I've got lots to say on this. Well, losing big business from big clients, yes. My response to that is be so good at your job that they want you more than you need them. And the work, show it and do it and keep your head down and prove it. at our law firm, you know, we've had plenty of big institutional clients wanting us to fill out, you know, our gender and race stats and who people like to sleep with. And I'm like, I don't know and I don't care. And I'm not going to tell you even if I did. And so we don't sign on to these, we don't fill it out. And I say, I'm sorry if you don't want to hire us because I'm unwilling to discriminate based on these immutable characteristics, then we're not the right law firm for you to hire. And so, you know, but that requires you to be really good at your job and having the demand to do it. And you know, and we have a niche business, and it's a little bit easy for me to say because our practice is so niche. And when you're a commercial litigator at a big law firm, but the, you know, it's harder to do that. But to differentiate yourself, and especially in a city where there's a ton of talent. But this whole conversation we've had, you know, Ed, you said we haven't talked about academia. All of this goes for in-house counsel too. The same conversation, change the dynamic in-house as well, because law firms, you're exactly right, David, law firms reflect the clients that they represent, and these big law firms have become the same institutional, you know, ethos that these big, that their clients are. And that is where, you know, that's where in-house counsel and conservatives who are working within these big, you know, ginormous companies can also affect change.
I just want to add one thing before General Scarametti gets to jump in here, but I see this all the time as well. At some point in time, this is part of the leave point. If the best conservative lawyers that they want to hire are no longer at the law firms that will play that game, they'll go hire them at their boutique law firms. I see it all the time. These boutique law firms, you think, okay, maybe they're doing some cause litigation here and there. They have real clients that are also paying some of the biggest names in town, but they want that guy or that girl to go do this case for them, and they will follow you to those places. I've seen it. It happens.
Yes.
First of all, huge fan since underneath their robes. second of all, you know, there is an alternative too, and it's something that we see playing out on the other side of the podium here, and that is you raise the black flag and you go after these big corporate clients. And I think we're, because of the way that there is this increasing cadre of feral conservative litigators cast out from the respectable world, there's this huge risk out there for corporate America of really good attorneys who are going to figure out that it is awesome to have a private plane. And, you know, there is a huge risk there. And at some point, people are going to start playing Moneyball in academia and in corporate America. But we're not there, right? We're at a really weird place, really conformist place. And that creates opportunities for those with the courage to seize them. And it's non-traditional, right? You go to law school, you go to the big firm, so that you get the guaranteed paycheck, and there is a clear path in front of you. But if you take the path less trodden, especially less trodden by the elite lawyers, the potential rewards are enormous. I mean, you could make a good living, and the potential upside is like your great-great-grandchildren will not have to work. And knowing that the intense legal geekery of the people in this room and in this hotel right now, like, that is a big advantage in litigation. If you get into court early and you're not scared of going to trial and you know the law well and you love practicing and you want to win so bad, you are a deadly threat to people sitting on very large sums of money, and there's a tremendous opportunity. So I think you're going to see an increasingly sophisticated conservative plaintiff side practice. And we have been driven to it, and there's going to be some people who make out very well as a result.
Yeah, and I think entire law review articles could be written on the question you asked at the very end, which is, why aren't market mechanisms sufficient to correct this problem? And this is a Federalist Society audience. Normally we would think we would trust the market to fix these issues. And we're normally skeptical of people who invoke theories of market failure all the time to justify government intervention. I'll just mention a couple things, and these are very skeletal remarks. These are publicly traded corporations that we're talking about. So they're owned by the shareholders. The people in the corporate C-suite who are pushing a woke political agenda are, in some cases, acting consistent with the views of the left-wing shareholders, but you could say they're breaching their fiduciary duty to the conservative shareholders. Now, I don't think that observation is enough to justify government intervention, because why don't the conservatives just divest their shares if they're unhappy with the way management is using their resources? Why would that justify government trying to come in and telling corporations, stop discriminating against law firms that represent certain clients? Now, all that said, we do have an understanding of what constitutes theft. I mean, the business judgment rule only goes so far. If I sued one of these woke corporations and said, I'm a conservative shareholder and I don't like what they're doing with my money, the judge will laugh at me and say, go away. Because he says, we have something called the business judgment rule. And again, if you don't like what they're doing, just divest your shares, sell them. But we still don't apply that kind of reasoning with, let's say, the Tyco executives. That's an extreme example from about 20 years ago, where the CEO of the company was basically looting the corporate treasury to pay for things like a shower curtain in his apartment in New York and a lavish 40th birthday party for his wife with people dressed up in Roman toga attire and all that. And they went to prison. That was actually considered an act of theft. Well, could a state say that this is theft? We're not going to apply the business judgment rule. We will just use our own criminal law to say this is a criminal misuse of shareholder resources. I think in theory they could, but again, the question that David asked, which is the really important one, is why? Why not trust the market here? So I've been struggling with these issues for over the last few years. I'm just going to put that out there. But these are very, very hard questions and interesting questions that we all have to think carefully about. And we need to get the theory right before we try to act on legislation or launch litigation to try to rein in this behavior.
Josh.
Yeah, that was incredibly interesting. I stood up because I wanted to talk about the academia question a little bit as an academic. I saw so many hands go up when you said how many people have graduated in the last 5 years. And I was thinking, well, maybe a few of them want to be academics. What does courage look like in academia? And I was sitting beside Josh Blackman right there and reflecting on his career and on my own. And I thought I'd share a reflection or two briefly and ask you for yours. I think the academia problem is in some ways less tractable than the problem that many of you have faced. I mean, it's not lost on me that half our panelists are working in politics and the other half in private practice. And so what you have to do is find a red state or a red federal administration, or what you have to do is find clients who will appreciate your skills or are on the right side of the aisle and will hire you. In academia, there are relatively few employers. They're highly collusive, and they are highly ideologically homogenous. And the problem is older than the problem you see in the private market. I sort of think that the woke movement arrived at the law firms at the end of a very long, long wave. Critical studies generally and critical legal studies centered on race, gender, and other immutable characteristics started in the 70s, started taking over the academy in the 80s. It was then called identity politics and political correctness. Closing of the American Mind, the famous response to it, was copyrighted in 1987. In the 1990s were the era of the culture wars, the first culture wars, right? And that's when you got the creation of African American Studies Department and gender studies departments and other things that signal the academy's commitment to those norms. And from the time I was a child, there was a process of ostracism of professors who had right of center ideas. And so I've thought a lot, as I've listened to the panel, about what how you can be a right-of-center thinker and still survive and even thrive in that environment. And I've only really seen two models sometimes in combination. So I'm just gonna sort of briefly state them and then invite your responses about solutions or if you agree or disagree. One model is very, very slowly lifting the lid off the pot. Is how I think of it. So that is to say, you come into the academy, you're mostly defined by your field, you're extremely technical, maybe you're doing something like law and economics, you're doing empirical regressions, or you're doing a particularly technical sort of federal jurisdiction or something like that. You kind of keep a lid on your views, people who know you kind of sense it, but it's not a big deal. You survive, you thrive, eventually you're tenured, you still hold your tongue till you let a little bit out when you're tenured. Eventually you're tenured at the school you want to be tenured at, because you're not really tenured until you're done moving around, and then you start speaking out quite bravely. That's one model. The other model is just to make do with less. You don't get to be in the prestige institutions, and you deal with the fact that you are potentially an extraordinary scholar who is not enjoying the fruits of being an extraordinary scholar. I think those are the only two models I've ever seen work, and I'm wondering if you think the situation is permanently as bad as that, or if you sort of see it differently than I do.
Yeah, I think there are two ways you can approach an academic career if you are conservative or libertarian or Republican. I think one is to follow the example of people like Jack Goldsmith or Will Bode, who've done very well in academia. They've gotten good appointments, they're respected, but they've done certain things to get there. They're genial, they're non-threatening, they don't go after the left's holy sacraments, and we know what the holy sacraments are: racial preferences, homosexuality and transgenderism, and abortion rights. You stay away from those three areas, and then also you can specialize. In some cases, I think it makes sense to specialize in an area that's not in public law. Law schools are more tolerant of conservatives on the faculty if they're teaching the subjects the left doesn't want to teach, and they don't want to teach law and economics, and they don't want to teach corporations or secured transactions or those sorts of things. So you may want to specialize in those areas at least early in your career, if you're hoping to advance in academia. The problem for me was I didn't want to do any of those things. I'm okay being genial. But I'm not willing to be non-threatening.
But I think you're seeing the pushback in academia.
Pushback from what?
I think you're seeing market forces correct here. So my client, Bill Ackman, has been very vocal in pushing back and calling out universities and wokeism on campus. And you see it in applications. I don't think it's yet at the faculty level. I think this is really a new phenomenon and it's just starting. But look at the increase in applications to SEC schools and the decrease in application to elite universities. I think it's starting at the undergraduate level. I think it's going to trickle upward to law schools and to, master's programs. And it will eventually get to, the clients and faculty and the positions, professional positions. I think it's going to take a while.
But the elite institutions are just as corrupt as they were before Bill Ackman's crusade. Yeah. All of his candidates for the Harvard Corporation were defeated. And Claudine Gay eventually resigned, but she's still on the faculty there. I don't know. I don't see much payoff yet. I hope I'm wrong.
I think as students are rejecting the top talent, again, moving with their feet, First Amendment choice and freedom of association, and are rejecting these elite institutions to go to, I think you're going to see SAT scores fall. I think you're going to see the prestige come down. I think it's going to take time, but I think there's a market solution to this, and I think it's happening.
Those of you in the room that I've worked with or who know me, you're going to probably roll your eyes at this, but I'm going to answer your question in a very different way that's not anywhere close to what your actual question is, which is about how you get to work for one of these universities with a professor titled next to you that does not say adjunct. There is a third way here if you want to offer your skills and your thoughts to the world and to the cause and to the movement. You don't have to be a professor to write intellectual articles. You might have to be a professor to get published at whatever, but I know there are dozens, if not hundreds, if not thousands of different ways to get your ideas out there into the world and to contribute scholarship, real scholarship, without getting into a book that's sent to 12 libraries that maybe somebody reads more or less than the pipeline of law review articles that you have to jump through all these hoops to get into. So if you have ideas, if you want to contribute, if you have thoughts, if you have scholarship that you want to add to the world, you can add it. And guess what is a better way to get attention than to get, whatever, LGA, whatever? It's get excited by the Supreme Court. So if you offer something out there that becomes part of a judicial opinion or becomes a footnote somewhere or becomes part of briefs, you have contributed as much or not more, if not more, than you might have done by playing all the different steps and jumping through all the hoops. So if there is a way you want to contribute, you can. It's beauty of the internet.
Let's keep going so we can maybe get through all the questions. Next one.
So Marco Brown from Salt Lake City. I wanted to maybe have the panel comment on something crass about just straight money, although we have talked about private jets, so I think we can, I think this is less crass than that. So speaking to the younger attorneys here that are coming out of law schools and they have the choice to go to big law or they're gonna go to smaller firms, I think one of the big reasons that they don't do that, that they choose big law, is they think they're going to make more money. And my personal experience is exactly the opposite. I make far more opening my own firm than I ever would have made at big law, but I wanted the panel maybe to discuss this a little bit and reassure younger attorneys that they don't have to go down that path with people that hate them, and they can go to smaller firms and make just as much, and what your experience has been of that.
Well, I don't know if I can say they'll make just as much in terms of money, but as I said earlier, your compensation package is more than just the salary. It's also the satisfaction and the psychic income you get from the cases you're working on. So if you're going to choose to go to big law, ostensibly because of the money, that's the signal you are sending is that package you get from big law, which is the salary plus all the woke garbage you have to put up with, is worth more to you than the total compensation package you would get at Constable McCarthy, where the salary, I don't know if it's as high as big law, but the psychic income, if you're a conservative, libertarian, or Republican, you would think is greater. And if you're choosing big law over that, that sends a signal. I mean, I'm a University of Chicago guy, so I believe that people act in their rational self-interest. So when I see people make those choices, those are the normal inferences that I draw. Now again, I wouldn't completely rule that against you if that's on your resume. I'm not gonna throw it in the trash can, but if I see a resume and someone's applying for a job and wherever, either with my firm or in the Trump administration, the first question I'm gonna ask them is, why are you working there? And maybe they have a good explanation for it, but that's the signal you send when you make that choice.
You know, this is probably a topic for a completely different panel, but on top of the pay you get from doing the things that you think are right on a day-to-day basis, which is huge and can't be discounted, you also get many other possible benefits from that. If you're in big law, you are on lockstep, you are constrained, you can't necessarily take the clients you want. You might not be able to live in the place you want. You might not be able to have kids at the same time. You might not be able to do this or that and the other. So I will say, you know, you're taking a little chance sometimes. You might be doing a trade-off, but the trade-offs might be right for you. And this goes back to not just being courageous ideologically, but be courageous in life. Do the thing that feels right to you. And I will say that I think for a lot of folks that end up there, the upside can be bigger, both monetarily and lifestyle-wise.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I can't speak for the other boutique firms. I don't know what their compensation model is or how well they pay. You come to our firm, you can make more than you make in big law. It's a meritocracy. It's based on evaluations of performance and evaluations of how much time you're putting in. The thing I hated about big law is it didn't matter if you billed 1,600 hours or 2,600 hours, everybody made the same base pay, and that struck me as wildly unfair. Because those 2 years are very, very different from a personal and what you're giving your clients and giving the firm. Those two, you know, equally situated folks at our firm make very different salaries. But it's not just about hours, it's contributing to the mission and the firm and clients and all of those other great things. So yeah, you come to our firm, you can definitely make more than you make in big law. You could also make less.
The other thing is it might be tied to your skills, your accomplishments, winning a big case.
Yep.
Without just straight hours.
Yep.
It might be that you can take a different type of client that you would never be allowed to take, not just ideologically, but you might be able to work on a project at a small firm that's completely different than what I would ever have been allowed to do at Jones Day, both ideologically and substantively. So there are so many trade-offs.
All right, 3 minutes left, two questions. Is that Andrea? I can't see.
Yes. Yeah,
go ahead.
Andrea Lucas. I'm a Republican commissioner on the EEOC. I had two questions. They were kind of, one of the first one was answered somewhat by that, but I do want to push it back on what Jonathan said. I'm talking kind of to the me who was 10 years ago. What you say sounds great, except if you come from an economically distressed background, the idea that the reward you get for what you're doing may not be an option for you. So, you know, I do want to push back a little bit of that. Sometimes big law is a short term when debt could crush you and you have your whole family relying on you is terrifying. And I'm, you know, 10 plus years past that after a decade in big law and now a long time in public service. But there are reasons why in the short term. So I thank you, all of you, for noting that there are ways still to be financially well rewarded in other other things. I think more information about that is really necessary. My other question is, how do you help conservatives get out of the dispositional mindset of being reactive and defensive? For me, I found it much more intuitively comfortable as a conservative to pick apart something, to be a defense lawyer, to not take a risk. The plaintiff's side is, I think, often a hard match for conservatives to start. For me, it's just been pushing myself outside of my boundaries, but I suspect there's a lot of people who are like, I'm risk averse, and it's real comfortable to just pick apart the other side's brief, not take the plaintiff's side. Is there anything people can do other than just really push themselves?
Go into government. Go into government. You'll learn how to do things that you never thought you would do in ways that you never thought you would learn how to do them. I think that's just one of the mind-expanding moments of life.
The other thing you do is you can get funding for your contingency fee cases. So don't, a lot of plaintiff work is done on contingency. A lot of there's the prospect of fee shifting under Section 1988 at the end of it, but you might want to partner with a 501c3 or a litigation funder who can pay your bills up front and take some of the downside risk in case the litigation fails. That's always an option. Please don't think that if you go out and launch a solo law firm, you're doing everything on contingency.
Yeah, and I would just say, look, from my perspective, for those who tend to be more risk averse and defense side oriented, our practice is reputation defense, and sometimes the best defense is a good offense. And so that's how I came from a very defense side background. And it only takes just a healthy skepticism of the media these days to come and work for us.
Last question, Roger.
Roger Severino, Heritage Foundation. So Jonathan, you said resistance is futile if you're in big law. So either don't go where people hate you, or leave as soon as possible, mm-hmm.
or be a mole.
There's a third option. Moles are for litigation. You could be a plaintiff. You were my lawyer in Severino versus Biden after mm-hmm. President Biden fired me from ACUS. Not every Republican member sued. Great decision, it'll come in handy in about a month and a half. Also, I was at DOJ Civil Rights under Obama, and I actually have a settlement agreement with the DOJ Civil Rights Division, and then I became a head of a civil rights office under Trump. So I think there is a path for people who say we have to stand up for ourselves, even if you're in the belly of the beast, and say, look, enough is enough, and come what may, we're in a fight.
Yeah, that's great. The only downside to being the named plaintiff is there will be a target on your back, and I'm glad that you're willing to have the target on your back, but not everyone has your courage and your gumption. So I've tried to create atmospheres where, well, for one thing, you can join a membership organization like SFFA and have that serve as your plaintiff. That's what I did with Northwestern. I created a membership organization so the moles, the faculty moles or the student moles, wouldn't have to have their name mentioned in the complaint and in the caption. But listen, if you're willing to put your name out there, all the better. I just think that may be a pretty heavy ask to make of people, especially early in your career. And I don't want any of you to hurt your careers over this, right? Because this is going to the point about being courageous but ineffective. You don't want to do so much on the courage side that you undercut your effectiveness because you put a target on your back and you've gotten yourself blackballed. So it's a very delicate balancing act that you're describing here. And I'm very happy with the choices that you've made by being a named plaintiff and sticking your name out there. But I think for some younger attorneys who are just getting started in their career, that's really asking a lot. So
we are out of time, so please join me in thanking the panelists.